Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Gregory Stockel, and Dan Friedel. Later, Anna Mateo will tell us all about change on this week's Words and Their Stories. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
10 years ago, scientists were shocked when a huge amount of seaweed appeared in tropical waters in the Atlantic Ocean. The area where it was found usually lacks the nutrients to feed such growth. Years later, a group of U.S. researchers has identified one of the leading causes for the event: city and farm runoff carried by rivers to the ocean. This nutrient-charged outflow is just one of several likely suspects fueling an explosion of seaweed in warm waters of the Americas. Scientists around the world say they suspect the cause involves a complex mix of climate change, Amazon rainforest destruction, and dust blowing west from Africa's Sahara Desert. There are probably multiple factors driving the growth, said Ajit Subramanian. He is an ocean expert at Columbia University. I would be surprised if there is one clear villain, he added. Seaweed is a kind of plant that grows in the sea. The dark brown seaweed is also known as sargassum. A recent study examined the chemistry of sargassum from the 1980s up to 2019. The results of the study offered the strongest evidence yet that water coming from sewage and agricultural runoff played a major part in the expansion of the so-called Great Atlantic Sargassum Belt. The area now stretches for nearly 9,000 kilometers. The study found that sargassum recently collected in coastal waters from Brazil to the southern United States contained levels of nitrogen that were 35% higher than in samples taken more than 30 years ago. The study's findings appeared earlier this year in the publication Nature Communications. Nitrogen is found in human and animal waste and in fertilizers. The results suggest that runoff flowing into rivers throughout the Americas and into the ocean is feeding sargassum growth. Ocean flows or currents carry much of this seaweed to the Caribbean Sea. The researchers found that changes in the Amazon River have played a big part in the seaweed growth. Brian Lapointe is one of the writers of the recent study. He is with Florida Atlantic University. He told Reuters that stronger rainstorms over the Amazon have led to more extreme flooding. This, he said, is likely pushing more nitrogen-rich runoff out to sea. Experts note that extreme Amazon River flooding pushes a large amount of nutrients hundreds of kilometers out to sea during March and April. That is also when sargassum blooms appear. From there, currents push the seaweed around the coast of Venezuela into the Caribbean Sea. Sometimes the seaweed makes it farther north into the Gulf of Mexico. Climate change is also fueling stronger hurricanes. The ocean storms can pull more nutrients up from the seabed to possibly fertilize sargassum. Scientists have also suggested that dust from the Sahara Desert, along with smoke and ash, could play a part in the seaweed boom. As the particles are blown west over the Atlantic Ocean, they run into clouds. They then get rained down as iron and phosphorus deposits in the water. It will take many more years of research to prove exactly how much each of these conditions may be contributing to sargassum's growth. But scientists say there are still things governments can do to make a difference. This phenomenon will continue until there is a change in public policy, said Carlos Noriega. He is an oceanographer at Brazil's Federal University of Pernambuco. Brazil, for example, could slow deforestation, which has led to a rise in cattle ranching. Raising cattle leads to loose soil, waste, and fertilizer washing into rivers. Noriega also noted the rising human population in Brazil's Amazon area. The five largest cities in the area have grown by nearly 900,000 people since 2010. Much of the region lacks effective sewage treatment. Treating sewage and stopping deforestation, Noriega said, that's the only way to control it. I'm Brian Lynn.
Zimbabwe is requiring its 500,000 government employees and several other groups to get vaccinated against COVID-19. This sets the Southern African nation apart from nearly every other in Africa. Many African countries are having difficulties in getting enough shots. Zimbabwe said it has more than enough vaccines. The country bought most of them from China. The government says the difficulty has been the people's lack of trust in the vaccine. This is partly because they distrust the government. But Zimbabwe's plan is raising worrying questions about the rights of its citizens. Researchers at Johns Hopkins University record information about coronavirus infections around the world. They found that Zimbabwe has reported about 130,000 virus cases and about 4,600 deaths. Those numbers are likely to be too low. However, the virus has not affected Zimbabwe as strongly as other countries. This might add to the lack of urgency Zimbabweans have in getting vaccinated. Critics say that Zimbabwe's government is not able to administer the vaccination effort. Centers sometimes run out of the injections, and poor urban and rural areas have not received shots in recent months. The critics also say it is cruel to put at risk the livelihoods of people who are some of the world's most vulnerable. Dewa Mavinga is the Southern Africa Director for Human Rights Watch. He said the government of Zimbabwe should first make sure that vaccines are equally available to all people before requiring them. Mavinga said distrust in the vaccine should be dealt with in a way that builds public trust and confidence in the vaccines without the use of force. Rights activists describe Zimbabwe's government as authoritarian. It appears ready to continue enforcing its vaccine rules. The government already requires vaccines at religious places and has suggested extending the enforcement to public buses. Public buses are very important to the country's poor. Markets, which millions need to buy or sell goods, might also be restricted. Those measures would effectively make the vaccine a requirement for nearly all Zimbabwean adults. This includes the two-thirds of the working population who are unlikely to experience enforcement from their employers.
Some Zimbabweans have waited hours only to be told their vaccination center was closing because of a lack of supplies or employees. People who can receive the second shot have also been turned away from centers which give preference to those seeking the first shot. However, new supplies of the vaccine have arrived recently, and lines appear to be getting shorter. Around 15% of Zimbabwe's 15 million people are fully vaccinated. This is above the 4% for all Africans, but far from the government's goal of 60%. The country has received 12 million shots. They are mostly the Chinese Sinopharm and Sinovac vaccines, which require two shots. Johns Hopkins University has found that just over 5 million have been administered. Peter Mustasa is the president of Zimbabwe's largest labor organization. He said the government is to blame for not vaccinating enough people. Workers have been trying to get vaccinated, he said. Mustasa's organization, the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions, is fighting enforcements for workers in court. It is one of the only organizations in the country to be publicly opposed to them. Other groups appear unwilling to speak out for fear of being considered anti-vaccine. Mustasa is not against the shots. He said connecting them to employment means jobs will be lost unnecessarily. The economy collapsed just over 10 years ago with high levels of inflation. Nearly half of Zimbabwe's population lives on less than $1.90 a day. Dr. Agnes Mahomva is the chief organizer of the government's COVID-19 efforts. She defends the requirements, saying they are aimed at protecting everyone. She argues that they remain voluntary in a way. If one doesn't want to be vaccinated, no one is going to come to their house to grab them and vaccinate them, she said. But Mustasa noted that workers who truly need the money have no way to say no. Acholo Johnny repairs machines in Zimbabwe. He cannot go back to work until he is fully vaccinated. After waiting at first, he decided to get the shots. Until he is fully vaccinated, he is selling whatever he can on the streets to make some money while he does not receive his usual pay. How are you going to survive without a vaccination card in this country? He asked.
I'm Gregory Stockel.
And I'm Dan Novak.
The Chair is a new program about life at an American university that might be of interest to foreign students coming to the United States. The main actor in the show is Sandra Oh. In The Chair, Oh plays Ji-Yoon Kim, an English professor at a fictional college in the northeastern U.S. When the show begins, Kim is in her first days as the leader or chair of her department. She is the first woman to have the job. Kim oversees a group of professors and also talks often with another official of the university, a dean. They discuss many issues. These include how to increase the number of students in English classes, how to add more professors of different races and ethnic groups, and whether older, unpopular professors should keep their jobs. The show brings up problems facing college professors and their leaders in 2021. It talks about how Black professors feel while working at schools where the students and teachers are mostly white. It talks about whether universities should change the system of offering tenure to professors. And it asks if professors should have the freedom to teach the way they believe they should. It also looks at the trouble Kim has dealing with her job and her home life. She is a single parent of a young adopted daughter and has a retired father who lives in the same town. Oh's character speaks Korean with her father and tries to teach the language to her daughter. All the issues come up in just 6 programs. The show is not real and is a comedy. It is not trying to be a real record like a documentary. But it does present real problems at colleges. So, how well does The Chair show life on a college campus in 2021? Jay Belsky is a professor of human development at the University of California, Davis. Belsky started his work in higher education in the 1970s when he completed degrees at Cornell University in New York. He said the stories presented by The Chair are close to life on a college campus in 2021. However, it is unlikely all the difficult events would happen at once. In addition, Belsky said Pembroke, the fictional college of The Chair, only represents the environment at a small number of U.S. universities.
While some of the wokeness and political correctness is in all of them, it's probably a lot more intense and apparent and all-encompassing at those elite of elite schools.
Shira Bala is in her final year of study at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. Dartmouth is one of the oldest colleges in the U.S. and an Ivy League school. Bala wrote about The Chair for The Dartmouth, the student newspaper. In her report, she wrote that the show captures the peculiarities of life on a college campus and noted that it balances being a comedy with tragic realities. She also commented that the outdoor scenes from the chair reminded her of Dartmouth, although the show was mostly filmed in Pennsylvania. Is the chair good to watch for a student considering study in the U.S.? Bala thought of her mother, who grew up in Malaysia. She said her mother often asked whether life at an American high school and college was like the life shown in movies and television.
Yeah, I think for a student from Asia, from anywhere outside America, I think it could be a very interesting show to watch.
Bala approved of the show's attempt to show an Asian woman as a university leader. She noted that U.S. universities are currently having really important conversations about diversity. Oh's parents came to Canada from South Korea in the 1960s. Speaking to the Associated Press, she said it was important that her character had a Korean first name. Her best-known television characters have been named Christina and Eve. To be actually able to put a Korean name and have all the characters say your name, it really appealed to me, Oh said. The Chair is the first movie or television show in a number of years to tell a story about a professor at an American college. Some critics said it is the first to do so since The Wonder Boys. That film came out over 20 years ago. The Chair shows two sides of Kim's life, as a university leader and as a single parent. While Bala is a young person, she has experience with academia because she followed her father, who is a professor at the University of Kansas. She said she is glad the show tries to show current college life.
The show definitely has kind of this current perspective, which was refreshing to see in a show about academia.
Belsky, the human development professor, said it is important to remember that Kim leads the school's English department. He proposed that a show about engineering or chemistry might be very different.
So I think you really have to make a distinction between the humanities and social sciences versus the rest of the campus.
Belsky also proposed that while the show is getting noticed, it is possible that it may only connect with a small percentage of Americans. Not many people in the U.S. attended schools like the one in the chair. Bala thought one part of the show was overstated, the idea that older professors are out of touch and unable to connect with the current college students.
I've been really lucky to have professors who are energetic, brilliant, and like on top of any new developments in their fields.
I'm Dan Friedel.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Today, we talk about change. The world changes. Situations change. But what about people? Do we ever really change? To answer this, we turn to the animal world to describe changes in personality and behavior. A common expression states that as we get older, it gets harder to change and harder to learn new behavior. That expression is, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. This expression does not mean that it is impossible for an older person to learn something new. Anyone can learn a new skill later in life, from speaking a new language to playing an instrument. But sometimes as a person gets older, they get used to doing things in a certain way. it is more difficult for them to learn a new way of doing things. Some people, this expression claims, get very set in their ways. They do not like to change. They like to wake up at the same time, eat the same thing for lunch, and watch the same news program. People who fit this description take comfort in routines. Of course, this is not true for everyone. Many older people adapt and change very easily to new situations. But perhaps they were always like that, even when they were younger. They are just staying true to their nature. And that brings us to our next expression. A leopard doesn't change its spots. This expression means that a person will stay true to their nature. They are who they are and cannot change, even if that person claims otherwise. We often use this expression when talking about someone who says they have changed their ways. They no longer do something bad that they used to do. Here is a very short story using these expressions. Listen for other expressions that relate to a person not changing. Years ago, I lived in a beautiful apartment, but it was too big for me. So to save some money, I invited a woman to move in. She was a friend of a friend of a friend. So I did not know her, but I was told she would be a very good roommate. And at first, she was. Then her true colors came out. First, she was messy. She left her stuff everywhere. When I told her to pick up after herself, she just laughed and said, "I was messy as a little girl, and I'm still messy. You know what they say, you can't teach an old dog new tricks." Well, I didn't think that was very funny. Besides, she was too young to be an old dog stuck in her ways. Then she started doing other things, worse things. She would take my stuff and lie about it. She would eat all of my food and not buy any food herself. Finally, she started throwing loud all-night parties and inviting all kinds of strange people to the apartment. That was the last straw. I had had enough. I told her she had to find a new place to live. Well, after only a week of looking, she said she could not find one. This I found hard to believe. There were always apartment for rent signs around town. But we had a serious talk, and she promised me that she would change her ways. She would turn over a new leaf. She would clean up her act, so to speak. So I let her stay. That was a mistake. She soon fell back into her old ways. It turns out the old saying is true. A leopard doesn't change its spots. In the end, I found her another place to live. She is now living with that friend of a friend of a friend. Problem solved. And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.